Welcome to Real World Rewind, a monthly podcast where we take a look back at some of our favorite movies from years gone by, reminding ourselves that entertainment is not mindless. In this month's episode, we'll be expressing our anticipation for Disney's live-action adaptation of Beauty and the Beast, which is set to release next month, by taking a look back at their 1991 animated classic of the same name. And joining me in this conversation about this tale as old as time is returning guest and professional Disney fanatic, Shannon Grimes. Thanks for coming back on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hashtag wife. Wife appearance.
That is me.
Yep, it's going to be fun. And I'm fully expecting Gene to mention that you got to come back in the in his What I Learned summary. So
it better be good.
Yeah. Well, like I mentioned earlier, Disney's Beauty and the Beast was released in 1991. It is directed by Gary Truesdale and Kirk Wise, and it features the vocal talents of Paige O'Hara, Robbie Benson, and of course, Angela Lansbury, just to name a few. It also boasts a score by legendary composer and Disney collaborator Alan Menken. So we will start off our discussion today by talking about our own personal histories with the film. So, Shannon, why don't you kick us off and talk about your personal history and love for this film?
Well, I cannot say that I remember the first time that I saw it because I was not 18. I don't have a big epic viewing of it like I did with Tangled. But I do really love Beauty and the Beast. I'm sure I saw it when I was really little. We had it recorded on VHS. And we would always fast forward through the commercials. But it's always been one of my favorites. I think just because the character of Belle is so wonderful and graceful. And she's independent and educated. But she's not snobby about it. She's not like, oh, I'm an independent woman. She's very, she's very much what I feel like. Like a Disney princess should be. She is strong and she is willing to use her mind, and she is also very kind. So I think that's why I really like the movie the most. And of course the music's fantastic, and you really can't go wrong with any of the songs in there.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with Alan Menken ever.
Nope.
I think looking back on my personal history, I remember seeing this as a really, really young child. And it was a movie that I watched quite a few times. And it's always in my, if I'm trying to rank my love of the Disney films, it's always very, very high on my list. And I think part of that is because Belle was my first Disney princess crush.
Well, that makes sense.
And I loved to read, even as a little kid, and so she loved to read, and I just thought she was great. And I remember getting to meet her. I remember getting to meet her at Disneyland when I was, I think, 5 years old, and it was extremely awkward because I was really nervous and blushing and all of that good stuff.
That's a really nice picture. I want to see that picture.
Unfortunately, I don't think the pictures exist, but. I have loved Beauty and the Beast ever since I was a little kid. And oddly enough, now that I'm grown, I kind of forget about it from time to time, when I'm thinking back, to films that I loved as a child, but it is there. And every time I watch it, I'm reminded again of how much I loved this film as a little kid.
Because it's fantastic,
right? So I think one of the most obvious things we can talk about when discussing Beauty and the Beast is its recurring theme of beauty and then obsession with beauty even. And a lot of the stuff, as far as that theme goes, isn't exactly subtle, and nor is it trying to be. But you pointed out something when we were watching this again the other night that I hadn't really thought about that much, and it was about the townspeople's fascination with beauty. So can you go ahead and talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, I guess I hadn't really noticed it until this time viewing it either, but I had always kind of thought of Gaston as the one, and maybe the Beast, as the ones that were really, like, obsessed with beauty. Like, of course the Beast is obsessed with beauty because, he turns down the ugly old woman, and he's he's just thinks his life is over because he's ugly now. And if we know Gaston's, you know, a stuck up, handsome man. But it was interesting to me to note how really Belle and her father were the most, they were the most different from the others because they were kind of the only ones that you could clearly see were not obsessed with beauty. Like all the townspeople, if you watch the song, which it's like a 7-minute song, so it goes on for a long time. But they're all singing about Belle and they talk about how beautiful she is. And they're like, well, but she's strange, but she's so beautiful, but she's strange. And then if you really look at the people kind of as they look out their windows, they kind of sit there and they stare at her and they kind of linger and they're like, well, I just wish she wasn't so strange because she's so beautiful. And just so much could happen if she wasn't so strange, you know, if she didn't read books and crazy stuff like that. And then also when you get to the other part where they're fascinated with beauty, not the person of Beauty and Beast, but actual outward appearance, where I see that again is when Gaston is trying to convince them to go kill the Beast. And Belle is trying to tell them, like, oh, no, he looks kind of bad, but he's really kind and gentle, and he wouldn't hurt anyone. And then they listen to Gaston, and he's like, no, I mean, look at him. Look how scary he is. He's going to eat your children. And they're like, oh, okay, he looks bad. Let's go kill him because he's ugly. And it's interesting how, like, the entire town shifts their views the drop of a hat, really, against the people that the person that is not beautiful and for the person that is beautiful. And really that's kind of all they ever talk about. Like every time that we interact with the townspeople, they're like, okay, well, he's ugly and so he's clearly bad, and she's beautiful and so she's clearly good, but I just wish she wasn't strange because she's so beautiful.
Yeah, it's interesting how the entire town is so superficial, and they seem to be driven by this obsession with beauty, and external beauty. And even now thinking about that, the song, oh, I'm blanking on it, Gaston's song in the pub.
I think it's called Gaston's Theme.
Yeah.
It's just Gaston.
I mean, the entire time, LeFou is just talking about all, I mean, most of what he's mentioning, you know, are his physical features. His neck is thick. He can spit. He's covered in hair. All the stuff that's apparently good.
But he's got biceps to spare.
Yeah. But it definitely seems to be a critique of a society that is overly obsessed with superficial beauty. And so, like you said, it's just a shame that they keep saying, oh, it's just a shame she's so weird because she's pretty. She could have it all.
She has potential, but then she reads.
Right. And that seems to be how most of its intellectuals are. I mean, her dad is seen as this crazy person who's literally, you know, they try to put him in an insane asylum. Gaston does. And so anybody who doesn't conform to the sort of social standards they've got set up, they ostracize from the community. I don't know, because I've never read the novel, the story on which it's based. I don't know whether that's a holdover from the novel. I'm sure it is in some sense, but it certainly fits well.
They probably don't sing a song about it, but
yeah, but it's certainly a good holdover, and speaks pretty presciently to American society. Mm-hmm. So that was something really good that you pointed out that I had not really thought about in terms of that song before. Even though obviously there's lots and lots of talk about beauty in the film that's right there on the surface. One criticism that's also leveled at this movie a lot, it seems like, is that this movie presents a classic case of Stockholm syndrome that potentially presents, some people say, an unhealthy view of relationships to young viewers. In other words, Belle is there to sort of teach young people, and I guess especially young girls, that it's okay if you're in an abusive relationship, because ultimately you can change them or things can get better and things like that. I've heard this criticism and read this criticism a number of times. I don't know. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that. Do you think Belle's relationship is a result of Stockholm syndrome?
Well, I mean, I think it's a funny accusation. Like it is funny because there is kind of a way in which I could see where someone would say that. But if you actually look at it, you see that she at first of all, she wasn't actually captured. Like, she sacrificed herself. She surrendered in order to save her father. And so there's that. Like, she wasn't actually captured. And second of all, really, Stockholm syndrome, I think, it's supposed to apply when, like, someone doesn't actually, the captor doesn't actually get better. Like, they continue to abuse the person. And if you look at the movie, I mean, the movie, I think, takes place, really, it's like a 3-day period. It's like the day that the dad goes and gets captured, and then I think she saves him that same day. She comes later that night, and then it like takes one more day for Maurice to go back and try to get town support, and then the next day they try to throw him in jail, and then they go and go try to kill the beast, and then, you know, the movie ends because of the big fight and everything. So I think it's only about 3 days long, but in that period of time, you see tremendous change in the beast. Like, it's not just because Beauty decided to love him that he changed. It's she decided to love him because she saw him changing. It's not him changing because she loved him. It's kind of cyclical, I guess. But
it seems like those things all work together.
Yeah, it's not that she was loving him just because she was like, well, I'm captured here, like I guess I'll get used to it and things. Like, she actually saw him becoming a better person. And, you know, the little song that she sings when they're playing in the snow, like, there's something sweet and almost kind, but he was mean and he was cruel and unrefined. But there's something there that I didn't see before, or something. Like, he actually does become a more caring and loving person, which is not something that you like actually would see with someone in Stockholm syndrome. Because it's more showing that the beast changed and she's loving him as a result of his change more than her just changing her opinion and, you know, becoming a I can't think of the word.
I can't help you out right now.
Like, she's a doormat and becoming a doormat. Okay, yeah. There we go.
Yeah. Well, and you bring up some really good points, and I think, too, I do understand where this criticism comes from, and I suppose you could, you know, I suppose there is a legitimate argument to say that it is Stockholm syndrome to a certain extent. But I think in addition to all the things you brought up, you have to look at all of the opportunities Belle has to leave the beast for good. Yeah. I mean, she does leave, you know, with his permission to go see her father, but he doesn't say leave and then come back. For all he knows at that point, he's losing her forever. And like you said, that's also not that's not a characteristic of someone who is holding someone prisoner, right? Mm-hmm. Usually someone who is perpetually abusive is not okay with somebody leaving and just kind of going off on their own. That's a big character development point for the Beast when he realizes that he loves her enough that he's willing to let her go. And she does indeed have the chance to leave him for good, and not come back. So, it's not just like she's cooped up for so long that she begins to love him.
Yeah.
Which is what happens in with Stockholm syndrome typically. Also, if you have to look at her relationship, I think, with Gaston, who is basically a mirror image of the Beast. He's just another Beast character, except he's beautiful. He's handsome.
And he doesn't change.
Yeah, and he doesn't change. But he has all of the negative character traits that the Beast does. And she has absolutely no interest in him whatsoever, even though he is handsome. And she says that. She says, oh, he's handsome, all right, but he's rude and conceited. So she's not interested at all in him. And that, I think, part of the reason that we get that information delivered to us is so that we can see that she's not just someone who will fall for whomever, right?
Yeah.
She's
got a brain.
Yeah, she's not going to be interested in someone who is just a big jerk. And it's also not clear in the story, or I guess it, what I'm trying to say is, it is clear in the story that Belle doesn't necessarily fully love the Beast before he loves her enough that loves her so much that he's willing to let her go. Because there's a conversation, I think, with Cogsworth and Mrs. Potts, where they're talking about how he loves her so much, shouldn't this break the spell? And I think it's Mrs. Potts who say, well, that's not enough. She has to love him back. So at that point, she still doesn't fully love him, even though he's changing. And obviously her feelings for him are growing. It's still not enough to break the spell. So again, the point at which she starts to fully love him, isn't simply just when she's captive. And again, she's not even captive for all that long, as far as we can tell.
It's like probably 2 days that she's actually captive.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the fight with Gaston also is a really powerful and symbolic moment for the character of the Beast, because it's this point in time when we realize that he has completely changed. Because if we look at Gaston as a mirror image of the Beast, when Gaston and the Beast fight at the end of the story, the Beast is essentially fighting himself. He's defeating he's sort of overcoming the negative aspects of his personality and leaving those behind, or literally like letting them fall to their death in Gaston's case. So I don't know. I don't see this as a case of Stockholm syndrome, of this case of this naive girl who comes in and just, you know, falls in love with her captor because she has no other recourse, or just because he gives her some books. Belle is a really smart character, and I don't think she's falling for any of that or succumbing to any of that. So that's just my take. I don't know. Did you have anything else to add?
No, that's very... That's like really deep, man. When you talk about the fight symbolizing, like I never ever thought of it that way. With, you know, he's like shedding his prior beliefs about beauty and letting them fall to their death. That's cool. I like it. Yeah. No, I don't think I have anything to add. Really, it's just like she's not captive that long, and like she makes all those decisions. Like you can see that she is not going to be fooled by anybody. She does what she does because she wants to do it. And it's not, if she was really being forced into something, it would be a very different movie.
Yeah. We talked about the beat. This is because we're rewatching The Office, so everything's Beats.
Bears, Beats, Beauty and the Beast.
The Beast. We talked about the Beast changing as a character. You brought up something about how that is shown through lighting, the way they light the character. Talk about that.
Oh, yeah. I noticed that it's not that long, but until Beauty appears on the scene with the Beast, we don't see him in light at all. We see when he transforms into the Beast at the very beginning scene, and we see him, you know, tearing up the castle. And then when he comes in and captures Maurice, the lights go out because he appears. Like, darkness comes with him. And then when they're up in the tower and Belle is going to find her father, you know, he's in the dark. And again, when he shows up, darkness appears. The lights go out. And she has to, you know, beckon him into the light in order to get him where she can even see him. And it's at that point that we start seeing him in smaller or larger and larger amounts of light. Like right there, he's in a little bit of the moonlight when she sees his face. And then I think the next scene that we really see him in any light, he's like standing by the fire. And then it's only when he actually starts to like calm down and lose his anger and lose his thoughts about how
terrible he is because he's ugly.
Yeah. Yeah. About his terribleness because of his ugliness, that we really start to see him in increasing amounts of light until finally he's like, oh, I'm in love with Belle. Like, this is great. Like, I understand that someone can love me even though I'm ugly. And then we start to see him in sunlight and, you know, in the dining room that is well lit and stuff. And it's like, well, Belle brings light with her because it's shining from within her. It's a true light that's not going to be easily quenched. Whereas the beast, you know, he had to let that beautiful, true beauty light in order to stop himself from being such a dark, menacing figure. And, you know, towards the end, it's, I guess, when he's fighting with Gaston. That's a thought. When he's fighting with Gaston, it's dark again. But then, you know, as soon as Gaston dies and the beast is turned into his former self and, you know, she declares her love for him, then everything becomes light again. And everyone realizes the true meaning of beauty and comes from within. And it's, you know, it's obvious there at that very end moment that true beauty comes with light and thinking about outward appearances comes with darkness. But more than that, there's lots of little things throughout the movie that help build up to that.
Yeah, that's really good. Lighting is always, it's always interesting to look at the way characters are lit, especially, not even especially with animated films, but animated films are interesting because with, you know, you're placing lights sort of virtually, so it's I mean, maybe even more so sometimes than with a live action film. Where you're placing lights can take on certain connotations. That's a bit of an oversimplification, but lighting is certainly an interesting tool that conveys meaning. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Thanks.
But yeah, I think Beauty and the Beast, also one of the things that made it stick out to me on a subconscious level, even as a kid who loved to read, was that it's a film that has a lot to say about the power and importance of good stories and how they can be formative for you as a person. So we learn very early on that Belle, one of the reasons she's strange, in fact, the main reason that she's strange, is because she's a woman who likes to read and learn, which is just
bizarre.
Oh, the horror.
They start getting ideas.
They get ideas, yeah. They read books without pictures. Who would want to do that? But she's a reader. She loves to read. I loved to read as a kid, and so I think I had that sort of connection there, like I talked about earlier. But one of the interesting things is that really the reason that Belle is able to see past, at least as far as what we have in the film, the sole reason we have from the text that Belle is able to see past the quote unquote ugliness of the beast, both inside and out, is because she has read so many good stories that have fed her imagination and showed her that darkness can and will be overcome. Mm-hmm. So one of my favorite authors ever, and I know I've mentioned him before on the podcast many times, probably. N.D. Wilson says that stories are catechisms for our imagination, right? They feed our souls, and they present to us a vision of what the good life looks like. And so stories, fictional stories, are not useless things that just make you weird or, you know, a time waster or any of these things, right? These stories actually feed our imagination and can change the way and help us see others in a different, more compassionate light. And that's something that's really important to me as someone who is just naturally more introverted and prone to be cynical. I need these stories to feed my imagination and remind me that we need to love one another. We need to do good to neighbor. Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, why Jesus told so many parables, stories about the importance of loving your neighbor. So stories have real power. We always say at Real World Theology that entertainment is not mindless, but also this story is powerful. And really, Beauty and the Beast is a perfect film to talk about how story is powerful. And it does that in a very meta sort of way that I really appreciate. I think the movie also talks about what happens when we let fear control our lives, mm-hmm. especially when we get into the third act, when we start seeing Gaston trying to conjure up this mob to go after the beast. You have thoughts on that?
I do, but I actually want to go back to what you said because I thought of something.
Sure.
Okay, so there's the scene, and you mentioned it, that Gaston is talking with Belle, and he's like, how can you read this? There are no pictures. She's like, well, some people use their imaginations. And that is interesting to me because I just thought about how that's another way that Gaston is focused on outward beauty. Like, he only cares if the book has pictures in it because he literally is not interested enough to go and read the words. Like, that's how little he thinks about. That's how little thought he is willing to put into something. He only wants to look at the pictures because all he cares about is the outside. Whereas Beauty, or Belle, is willing to put more. She's willing to invest more in things like people and in stories in order to get more out of it, which, you know, shows us, like you were saying, how important stories are because they feed the imagination. It's not something that you just want to see the pictures. Like, the more you are willing to put into a story, the more rewarded you're going to be because you're going to have all of these wonderful thoughts about how something should look. And what it really seems like in your head, like you're playing the little movie when you read it. And like, it's the same way with people, because the more that you're willing to invest in a person and the further inward you're willing to look, the more you're going to get out of it. Whereas Gaston would not be willing to do either of those things and doesn't get anything out of people because all he cares about is how they look.
Yeah. Yep. I also, there's a lot that could be really interesting to discuss about the rhetoric that Gaston uses to get Maurice put in the loony house, the Asylum de Loons or whatever it says on the...
I think it was Asylum de Loons.
Yeah. and all of the fear-based rhetoric that he uses to get the townspeople to go after the beast. I think a lot could be said about how that relates to the way we see fear-based rhetoric being used on, even a political scale here in America. But we are pushing up on our time limit, and I fear we would go pretty long on that. But I do think it's worth saying that Beauty and the Beast as a film...
We can do it short. I'll keep it to like a minute.
Beauty and the Beast does have a fair bit that suggests that, if we use that sort of rhetoric and we act out of fear, that'll ultimately be the instrument of our destruction, not our salvation. And I think that is something that I certainly could use to be reminded of more. And more often in my life. So go ahead and share your...
Oh, it's just interesting how Gaston uses fear when he's trying to rally the people. Like, he doesn't... he doesn't have any other thing to tell people except, like, look how scary this guy looks. He's going to eat your children. And, of course, they believe him because they're obsessed with outward appearances. And they're, one, being shallow, and, two, being driven by their fear and not willing to sit and think about it, which is another thing that the movie, of course, really encourages, is actually, like, making decisions that are based on rational thought.
In fact, even.
Maybe. I don't know. Seems pretty far-fetched. And so, you know, fear is the basest of the things that he can use, and he works with that immediately to get them out the door and run in a fear-crazed way, manner, towards the manor. And, you know, that's also, like, the beast is also, he's so scared that he is going to be rejected that he doesn't even think about Beauty being, you know, eligible. Like, he tells her to get out when she first comes in. Because he's so scared that he would never be able to be loved that he's just not even willing to sit down and think about something rationally for a minute. And so, you know, it's something that the movie points us towards, is that you have to actually think about things and use your brain, because your brain is important. And, I mean, the movie doesn't say this, but God gave you your brain and he wants you to use it instead of just acting out of fear and acting acting quickly.
Yeah, that's really good. So since we are recording this before the live action adaptation releases in March, there actually was a live action adaptation that I think released a year or two ago that it's a French adaptation, I believe.
I did not know that.
But Disney's live action adaptation is what we're really looking forward to. What are some things you're hoping the live action movie will do differently, or just what are you looking forward to seeing on the big screen? I can go first and say, that I am really hoping that we'll get to spend a little more time watching the beast relationship with Belle develop. It's pretty compressed in the animated film because it's a kid's film and it's, you know, an hour and 20 minutes. I'm hoping that we're going to get to see that grow and just fleshed out a little bit more. And then I love Angela Lansbury as Mrs. Potts. She's fantastic. But I love Emma Thompson. I think
love.
I think she is class personified. And I just can't wait to see her as Mrs. Potts. And I'm also very curious to see if she's going to sing There Must Be Something There That Wasn't There Before. That will be very interesting to see.
You mean Tale as Old as Time?
Tale as Old as Time.
Beauty and the Beast, just the theme. The Beauty and the Beast theme.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that will be interesting. I think one thing that I'm a little bit wary of in the new movie is hearing some of their singing, because I've heard on the trailer that it seems like it's very auto-tuned.
Emma Watson's.
Yeah, it seems like Emma Watson's voice is very auto-tuned. And, you know, it may sound fine in the movie, but I'm kind of hoping that it's not going to take away from the magic of it and turn it into more of like a pop star kind of thing. I'm hoping that it's not going to do that. But I kind of hope that it's more like the Broadway version. Because when we saw the Broadway version, I just loved it. Like, I loved the costuming, and I know the costume's going to be much different because they have computer animation to fill in the gaps, obviously. But, like, I hope that maybe one of the songs from the Broadway production makes it in. I really liked the song that the three, when LeFou and Gaston and the asylum guy, when they were hatching their plan, I really loved that song from the Broadway version. And I really hope that part of that makes it in. It probably won't, but it's just kind of fun there. So I'm kind of hoping that they do something like that. But Yeah, I agree that I'd like to see more of their relationship evolving. That would be pretty fun to just get more character development.
Yeah. I thought of a couple of other things. I'm really looking forward to the new Alan Menken song. Because more Alan Menken is always a good thing.
I think
I think he wrote at least one new song for the film. And so that should be really interesting to see. I'm very much looking forward to that. And then I love Gaston's song in the pub. And I think that has the potential to be so, so, so much fun on the big screen. That song's always kind of reminded me of the song, for some reason, Master of the House in Les Mis.
there's a difference in writing there, kids.
There is a difference in writing. But I hope it has that sort of, you know, that sort of spirit where it's just kind of loud and
dirty. Dirty bad.
No, not quite. Not that kind of dirty.
I mean like physically, like grungy dirty.
Yeah, I don't want like a Magic Mike song with guests or Magic Mike moment with Gaston or anything. But like just, you know, I hope it's a fun bar song. So that should be interesting to see before. that took an interesting turn. But I think that about does it for this week. I had a lot of fun talking with you about this.
Me too.
We will have to have you on for more Disney movies.
Yeah, any Disney movie, I'm game.
Because
or like Harry Potter or Hunger Games, I'll do those with you too.
Yep. Well, everyone, thanks so much for listening to our ramblings, our tired after work ramblings today. And make sure that you tune in next month for more exciting stuff from Real World Rewind. Please like Real World Rewind like Real World Theology on Facebook and follow Real World Theology on Twitter and subscribe to the show on iTunes and leave us a rating if you don't mind. But until next time, and as always, thanks for rewinding with us. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
Do 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 do. Hey!